A giant, a titan, a colossus of Irish politics and peace building. All manner of descriptions have been used for John Hume, who passed away yesterday at the age of 83. As Seamus Mallon, the former Deputy First Minister and Deputy Leader of the SDLP, noted in today's Irish Times in a piece that he penned prior to his own death in January of this year, John will be mourned by those who knew him in the political capitals of Washington, London, the European Parliament and in Ireland, North and South. But he will be missed, greatly missed, in the Derry that he loved so well, where despite his honours and his fame, he was, above all, our wee Johnny Hume. And so it's to Derry that we'll go first this morning. In a moment we'll hear from the Bishop of Derry, Donal McKeown, who will deliver the homily and the final words at John's funeral tomorrow. But first I'm joined on the line by Breed Rogers, who is founder member of the SDLP and former deputy leader and a colleague of John Hume's for many years, and also from Derry by Dennis Bradley, friend of John, former pupil of his, and of course a well-known community activist in the city. And good morning to you both, and thank you for joining us this morning. Dennis, I might start with yourself, because I think, as you say yourself, it's hard to know where to start indeed when you're talking about John Hume. But perhaps first, on a personal level, he was a hugely significant figure in your own life. How will you remember him?
Well, I came into contact with John first as a pupil in St. Columb's College, and he was a young teacher. Then we're back into the early 60s here, and he taught French, but he also taught history, and thank God he taught me history rather than French, because I wasn't good at French, and whatever talents I had, which were little enough, they lay around the history thing. But he approached history and the teaching of history in a, for us then, wouldn't be some perhaps so peculiar nowadays, but it was certainly different those days, that he got away from the tightness of looking at history from dates and kings and queens and battles and so forth. And he challenged us young men, it was all young men because it was Collins College, to actually think about what was going on our streets and in our country. And I remember particularly one day when he made us debate the subject of nationalists in Northern Ireland should join the Unionist Party and change it from within. And I mean, that stuck with me throughout my life, because that was kind of the challenge that he was throwing out to us at that age. And I think that those years of teaching served him well later on, because it taught him how to, I suppose, understand the audience that you're dealing with, and it taught him to use language that people could understand and go with and be inspired by. So all of that was my first memory of him. My last memories of him, funny enough, are very different, but they're as personal in a different kind of way. John, after the peace process ended, it didn't end, it has never ended, but when it came to its final stage and John began to move out and his own memory was affected, he became very vulnerable. And in many ways, I think that has endeared him to the people of the city even more, because when you see very good, important, historic people in their vulnerability, then in some ways it is a confirmation that we're all human, that we're all in this together, that there's none of us stand outside the human endeavours. And John was vulnerable in the sense that he used to go around the town and his memory wasn't very good, but you knew he was as safe as anything because Derry was looking after him. And then even as he went down the hill, you could see him being, you know, that Derry went out to him because they thought, well, he went out to us. He's one of us, and he's important for us, and he did important things to us and for us. And I think that those kind of personal things are almost more important even than the big historic things that will be written about and that are put in books, and which, by the way, he was very, very, very good at. But I think that in the next couple of days, and I think that even the thing about lighting a candle tonight, in some ways, we're moving out of the public frame here, and sometimes we forget that politicians, no matter how important they are, no matter how great they are human beings at the end of the day, and the lighting of the candle in a quiet reflection, I think, by the family, is almost another statement of the decency of that whole family and their insight that, you know, there are bigger things than just the public fame or the public expression of that. And I think that's very important within, not just within Derry, but perhaps that will be important in Cork too and in Galway, where people can reflect upon the death of somebody who's been very important.
You've mentioned his authenticity. Can you tell me a little bit more about that, Dennis?
Well, I think that his authenticity was lived out by the very fact. Some people might find this strange, others I think will understand it. He never left the Bogside. I mean, him and Pat lived in the heart of the Bogside, between Craigan and the Bogside, all of their married life, as far as I remember. I came back into Derry in 1970, and they were living in West End Park, and they're still living in West End Park. And when the talks began, when we were right into the heart of the British getting involved, the Irish government getting involved, the IRA getting involved, when there were difficult times, when we were talking about the people and when we were talking about the future and when we were talking about the past and when we were talking about Derry, in the sense that that within that living experience of a city that was divided, that used to have a great mixture of Protestants and Catholics living within it, and then the Protestants left and went to the east bank of the Foyle, John stayed in his own street, in his own house, in his own street. And even though it was petrol bombed one time, it was attacked, it was vulnerable, I'm sure the security and the police and so forth would have said to him, you should be living in a more safe area. He never left that spot. And I think that added to his authority, because he was not just some man who had come in from the outside, not somebody who had been there but had now left his people behind him and was kind of talking in a fashion which was external. He was of the place, he was in the place, he knew the place, he knew the people, and that I think gave him an authority out and beyond that which is quite often in or not in politics when it comes to real change, not just in external small economic issues, but in constitutional, passionate, historical issues.
Mm. And of course, Breege, people might forget just how young he was when he started having an impact in politics.
Yes, and people forget that John really was only in his early 30s. He began the credit union, of course. John was always about people and about helping people, and he saw the dire strait of people in Derry in particular, and he wanted to help, and that's why he became so involved initially in the credit union movement and then in the civil rights movement. And in the civil rights movement, my memory of John, he was Derry Citizens Action, I was Northern Ireland Civil Rights Association, and we met practically every weekend over 2 years in different places in the north. And that's when I first got to know him from that point of view, although I knew him in his earlier days in Gidor, when he used to come with his young family for a bit of crack and fun and relaxation before he was so involved. But my first memory of him at the civil rights meeting is that you always knew when John got up to speak that it was going to be something worth listening to, and he also had a calming effect, because those were very heady days, and you know, marches were going on and people tended to get excited and all of that, but John always had a calming effect when he spoke and people listened to him. That was in the civil rights movement. And then when he went on to form the SDLP, I remember well being excited about the fact that there was now going to be a new organisation, that there was going to be political organisation. And I remember at the time, I think, when the SDLP branch in Lurgan was set up, I was, I think, 8.5 months pregnant and ready to give birth. And in those days, you didn't go to meetings if you were in that condition. And I remember John rang me the following day to know why I wasn't at the meeting. And I told him why. And then subsequent to that, I wrote to John at one stage because I thought there was something going on in the council and I felt that the SDLP wasn't doing anything about it. I can't remember the issue. And I wrote to John and I said, you know, what are the SDLP doing? This is terrible. And he wrote me back one line and he said, what are you doing about it? And that was it. That was me involved. So, you know, John was inspirational. I remember the early days when John started then to appear on television with just debating with unionist politicians, and the calm, reasoned way that he actually, in a sense, demolished them with almost with a smile on his face. And he was saying new things that to people like me who came into Northern Ireland at the time when there was discrimination and when, Catholics, if you were a Catholic, you just couldn't get a job. Some Catholics didn't even bother applying for jobs, and there was discrimination in housing, and things were really bad, and nothing seemed to ever change because the unionists were in control. And here was this young man suddenly saying different things and saying, look, the way forward is, and he set out his strategy. And his strategy in those very early days are the strategy that is at the root of the Good Friday Agreement, which is you can't, as his father once told him, you can't eat a flag. And also the fact that violence was not just wrong and unjust, it was counterproductive. It actually galvanised unionists and kept them together instead of persuading them. And he began telling people, look, if you want a united Ireland, it's not going to be about the border. It's about the border in people's hearts and minds. It's about people having disagreements about what they are and who they are and where they should be. And John was using a different language, and he talked about reconciliation, about the need for agreement, and he introduced the word an agreed Ireland instead of a united Ireland, which was an agreement as to how the people who lived on this piece of earth could live together. And, you know, he inspired people to new ways of thinking. He changed the whole mentality of the people of Ireland, north and south. He changed a mindset. Mm-hmm. And then he got to work to change. His mission was to bring about the result of his vision, to establish what his vision was. And his vision was an agreed Ireland at peace with itself, with unionists and Catholics and nationalists and Catholics and unionists and Protestants all living together in a situation where they respected one another, where they recognised difference. As he often said, difference is just an accident of birth. He used to remind me, he said, Breed, your maiden name was Stratford. Where did that come from? You know, so he said, we're all accidents of birth. We have to recognize our humanity. He was a man of immense talent, of a philosophy that reached people. And the big thing about John is, I suppose it was the fact that he had been a teacher in his early days. He was able to communicate those things simply, and people understood it, and people trusted him. And he was a political leader at a time when leadership could not have been more important.
And indeed, Breed, we have one very short clip of John here, which I know is a favourite line of many people, because this summed up his response to people who criticised some of that approach that you're talking about, and indeed his controversial talks with Gerry Adams.
I don't give two balls of roasted snow, Jeff. What advice anybody gives me about those talks, because I will continue with them until they reach what I hope will be a positive conclusion.
And indeed, Dennis, I know you had a very similar experience to John in the sense of being involved in and facilitating the kind of back-channel talks that got the ball rolling towards peace. John's talks were at Gerry Adams, as I said, and you helped to arrange talks between the IRA and British officials. How influential was John, do you think, in how you viewed the conflict that was happening on your own doorstep?
Well, I suppose, Peter, sometimes we forget those years, how difficult they were, because public opinion really was not so much on the side where it is now, which is, you know, John did a wonderful thing and John was this and John was that. John was very fragile in those days, and the political parties were very fragile in those days, in that we were right in the heart of violence, and violence dominated everything. And really nothing could move politically until the violence was at least put aside in a temporary basis initially, and then permanently was the desire. So John had to enter into that, and he entered into it very courageously. My first memory of him entering into it was going off for it turned out, I think, for 3 days, where I actually drove him across the border from Derry down into Bridgend, and somebody else picked him up, and then he was put into the back of a van, and he was driven around for a couple of hours and taken to a house somewhere. He thought it was Donegal. It actually was Donegal. And he met some people who said they were the IRA, and they said they wanted to video these discussions. And he said, well, excuse me, this is not the way it's going to happen, and it won't happen like this. But in the meantime, his wife, Pat, was sitting at home worrying, I mean, where is he, and how long is he going to be away? And there was no contact, and there was no reachability with him, and he wasn't at the end of a phone. So to be in that type of situation for 3 days in that context was incredibly brave of him to do. Some people might have even at the time said it was stupid of him to do, but he did it. Now, nothing came out of those talks. But they were the beginning, they were part of the beginning of an ongoing beginning process, which led to something which became important. But in the middle of all of that, he had to go through, I suppose, people saying, don't do it, don't go there, or if you're going there, you're not going to have any influence because these people are irredeemable, or the British will be perfidious around this. You won't ever achieve that. And what we have to do is something different. But he had to take all of that on board. Some people then began to say he had to face down his own party. I'm not too sure about that, but Breach would be able to tell you more about that. But he certainly had to face down both, I suppose, the fear that we had been inculcated into us at that time, that you didn't deal with the IRA, that you didn't go to them, that if you dealt with them, you were giving them oxygen and you were giving them support. He had to take that on. He then had to take on, which was the greatest thing he took on, the possibility of failure. And I was critical then, and I'm critical now, of the way the IRA handled him. I think the IRA handled were very ungenerous, particularly the 9 months that elapsed between the initial or early talks and the actual ceasefire. Because what the IRA were doing was looking after the IRA and their constituency, and had very little respect, in my opinion, for John's constituency, which was the broad nationalists and his own party in particular. And I think that period of time needs a little bit more outing, in the sense that there's a lot, I think, to be talked about around those years. But that was a great... Those were, I think, the most burdensome periods, when he had to kind of hold his nerve. He had to hold his party to some great degree. He had to hold the Irish government to some degree, and he had to hold the British government while the IRA kind of sorted themselves out. They had a difficult constituency. I understood that at the time, and I understand it now. But I do think... John was not looking after, and I heard some of his own people say this yesterday, and I think it's true. When that important, vital, transformative moment came, John's initial priority was to get peace and the end of violence and the stopping of people being killed or injured. At that same time, the IRA's priority was to look after the constituency of the IRA, which was to make sure that the cause wasn't damaged. Now, in politics, when you're dealing with conflict, when you're dealing with the big violent horror that happens in so many countries, there comes a moment when you have to decide where your personality and where your life and where your beliefs and where your principles lies. And I think Hume's principles were the right ones. And I think that Irish republicanism needs to always look back and say, we were too self-absorbed, we were too interested in the cause, which is actually doesn't have human flesh around it, is some kind of ideology which overtakes the need for the human compassion and the human understanding.
All right, Dennis Bradley, friend of John Hume, and also Breach Rogers, founder member of the SDLP. Thank you both very much for joining me this morning. Now, a little bit earlier, I spoke to the Bishop of Derry, Donal McKeown, and I started by asking him what the mood in Derry has been like over the past 24 hours.
I think there was a real sense of sadness and pride. Those probably are the two things. Because, I mean, I'm an outsider to Derry. I'm only here 6 years, at 36 years in Belfast, but I'm only 6 years here. But there was that sense of sadness that John, who had made such a lasting impression on the life of the city over this past maybe 60 years, has eventually died after a long illness, but also a sense of pride that one of their own, one of the guys was on the radio this morning talking about having sat with him in Rosemount Primary School. You know, people were proud of somebody who came from the city and never left the city and still lived in the Cathedral Parish and was so just so widely known as one of the people, and whose wife is such a sterling star in the city as well. So it's pride and sadness mixed at the one time.
Yeah, one theme that has certainly come through very strongly all day yesterday is that John Hume always had his feet firmly on the ground in Derry. No matter where he was around the globe, Derry was never far from him.
Yes, and his party song was "The Town I Loved So Well," which is that very moving song by Phil Coulter. I mean, John was intensely practical. I mean, he began here with housing issues. He began by bringing in the credit union. He was concerned about what was affecting local people. He was quoted yesterday as saying what his father said to him at a political rally: "Don't get involved in that. You can't eat a flag." He was concerned about improving the life of local people, and that commitment to giving his life in the service of other people came across very strongly. John was always seen as a very real person. He wasn't an orator who was standing outside the life of the city. His relations and so on were all here. He lived locally. He drank at local bars. He went into the local shops. He was daily in the cathedral here for mass. So he's the sort of person who never lost his roots, because he was committed not to the party or not to any ideology, not to any ism. He was committed to making a better future for this city and for everybody who belongs to it.
And I know that John and his wife Pat were regular worshippers in St. Eugene's Cathedral in Derry, and that's where you'll be giving the homily and final words at his funeral tomorrow. Can you tell me what kind of reactions have you been hearing from Derry locals since yesterday morning, you know, chatting to people?
There was that sense of sadness that John had gone, because John has been a major figure in the life of the city and the country for so many years. I mean, he was married in 1960. That's what, 60 years of married life. So he was in the life of the city as a Stormont MP, then as a Westminster MP, as an MEP, as a Nobel Peace Prize winner, but he always was a local person. But what really does strike me about the whole organisation of the funeral is the family are very clear. This is a family funeral, and we don't want anything more for John Hume than we, Jimmy, or we, Maisie, round the corner would get. This will just be an ordinary, normal COVID funeral with all the limitations and no frills. We don't want a big fuss about it. We're just an ordinary family. And I think John had that sense of belonging to the local community and never having grown too big for his boots or grown out of the area or thought he was superior to it, even though he walked the corridors of power, the Nobel Peace Prize, the corridors of power in the States and so on. But he had a local commitment. I was talking to somebody this morning, Ewell Adair, who would have known him down through the years, and he remembers flying over to the States on one occasion because there was a threat of a factory that was here in Derry closing. They had a meeting that lasted 15 or 20 minutes. He went back on and flew back on the next plane back to Derry or back to Dublin or whatever it was. That sense of being committed entirely to serving the local community and ultimately to spending his life in the service of it. So tomorrow's funeral will be obviously tinged with sadness, but there'll be an element of gratitude just for a wonderful human being who, I think after discovering in seminary that he wasn't called to be a priest, still had a sense of vocation, that his life was a calling to be dedicated to the service of peace. And he spent his life, he burnt himself out absolutely in the service of that with a wonderfully generous heart. And I think people will remember that self-giving on the part of John and of all of his family who were involved. And I hope to post tonight with the candle for peace in the window and tomorrow with the funeral that we can be grateful for John Hume and let him go in peace.
Yeah, because obviously this is taking place in the middle of a global pandemic, and if it wasn't, I think it would be safe to say it'd be one of the biggest funerals that we'd have seen on this island for a long time. But unfortunately, that can't happen tomorrow. So can you tell us what is planned?
Well, the remains, there was talk of the remains coming in and people lining the road and coming in from their home between Maville and Greencastle, where they sort of live sort of for a country house rather than here in the city. overlooking Lough Foyle, but they decided, no, we want to come in tonight quietly, and rather than having people coming out at 8:30, they simply want them to log on to the Cathedral website here through churchservices.tv, ask them to put a candle in the window or the door of the house if they want to, and then with those in the Cathedral to pray St. Francis's peace prayer. So that they want this evening to be a prayer for peace, not just people out on the street, not just sort of large numbers, but quietly praying in the home. And there's no pressure on anybody. You do it if you want. You don't do it if you're not particularly interested. So there's no sense of having to be seen. And then similarly tomorrow, clearly there will be VIPs from the island, nobody from outside the island, at the Mass tomorrow. There'll be a number of messages, I think, from people coming from other parts of the world who can't be here. And then there'll just be the ordinary funeral Mass, and I don't doubt that the people of Derry will come out in numbers as the remains are removed from the cathedral up to the cemetery, but they want this to be a family funeral like any other family funeral in Derry in pandemic times, but they want it to be a time when people are praying and praying for peace, rather than just having a whole series of eulogies and a rather secular celebration which happens to be in a cathedral. They want it to be a time of prayer for peace, because that's what John Hume gave his life for.
And that was Bishop of Derry, Donal McKeown, speaking to me a little earlier.
Today with Sarah McInerney on RTE Radio 1.